This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 123rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're almost all Italian today. Or we half are. We're Roberto, but still Bound, perhaps. We're celebrating the new all-Italian issue of Monocle by parking our Fiat 500 next to some of the choicest parts of a fine culture. So first, you'd be mad to love Italian pop music, wouldn't you? Well, no. We give you Italo Disco.
I love pop music and I love electronic music and I like magic and melody and in my music, and this is the perfect combination. I never get bored of it.
We'll also hear what Milan's San Siro Stadium sounds like as we go to a match with one of Italy's finest football writers. Then we switch gears to Germany for the Berlin Film Festival.
The traditional platforms, cinema and television, are losing their importance. They will always exist, but in 5 years' time, they will represent maybe 15% of the whole landscape.
And we keep our eyes square as we assess the impact of the new series of House of Cards from DVD rental turned production powerhouse Netflix.
This was the first real show that you could have seen on traditional television. And, you know, there'd been web video before and there'd been, you know, attempts at smaller scale productions, but this was the first that was a real big deal.
That is all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Allora, we'll start with a song. In fact, we'll start with a song that illustrates and illuminates our theme. Pop music? Italian pop music, you might well ask. Well, yes, indeed. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to kick off this Italian-leaning show by discussing and deconstructing the magic of Italo disco, that genre that bestrode the dance floors of Italy and beyond all through the 1980s and can still be found on the better dance floors of the finer parts of the nicest capitals of Europe. We'll start with a great example of the genre, Tarzan Boy by Baltimora, and if you can handle it, we'll come back to Earth to speak to two experts on all things Italo. So we warned you, that was the sound of one of Italy's finest cultural exports, this side of Canaletto and Masked Balls. It was Tarzan Boy by Baltimora. And to discuss just what that was, Italo disco, I was joined by Piers Martin, an associate editor at Vice, and who's working on a book on Italo disco, and Severino Panzetta, one half of London's legendary horse meat disco. And we tried to track down just where Italo disco came from.
I really like Giorgio Moroder. I think it was kind of like he started like that, which is actually technically Giorgio Moroder. Well, he obviously grew up, like he's all about Munich machine and Munich and stuff like that. But actually, technically, as far as I know, he's originally from Trentino Alto Adige, from the Alto Adige region, which is still in Italy, even if they're really, really attached with Austria. So technically, he's Italian, as far as I know. But yeah, obviously, it was the Giorgio Moroder synth, lots of synths, and Be Happy, and kind of like, yeah, create these kind of sounds, like synth and bass.
A lot of Italians as well, I guess maybe they couldn't afford to buy all the US disco stuff, so they could basically try to make their own kind of Italian funk and disco records and pop records. And they looked to the UK where Gary Numan and OMD were huge in the charts, and they thought, okay, let's give it a go ourselves. And so that's where the things became a bit lost in translation, I suppose.
Italo disco was Italian pop music of that era. It's been fetishized and collected now, and it's obviously very valuable now. Certain discs, certain kind of key discs on certain key labels, I guess, are worth lots of money now. Yeah. But back in the day, it was basically simply Italian pop music that was trying to ape the styles of US or UK disco pop of that era.
Correct, and obviously obviously more of them like obviously in English language, so like trying to be like try to escape, like to be international, even if
We'll have like on that record on the Baltimore, it's suddenly a sort of a shouty English chorus coming out of nowhere.
That's the kind of that is the kind of classic Italo chorus that, you know, even the Pet Shop Boys would rip off at a later date. And the Pet Shop Boys also did that track Paninaro in 1986, which kind of referenced Italian fashion as well.
Correct.
Yeah, the Italo sound had a big influence on the Pet Shop Boys. Passion and love, sex and money, violence, religion, justice, death.
What are the constituent parts of Italo disco? What's the beat? What are the sounds? I wonder what if there are three or five things, whether there are things that make a disc an Italo disco disc.
There's essentially three criteria that make an Italo record an Italo record, and that is it has to be made between, say, 1982 and 1987 in Italy. It has to be composed using broadly or purely electronic equipment, and it has to have English lyrics, ideally sung by an Italian. Yeah, the golden era is between 83 and 84, really. That's when some of the craziest stuff was made. And then from about 85, when MIDI was introduced, and things got a bit more slicker and a bit more commercial, and the sound was a bit not as interesting.
The program sound,
and they realised that they could maybe make some money abroad, so they're maybe a bit more cynical in their approach. And then by about 87, 88, things sort of tailed off. Well, the kind of innocence was lost for Italo, I think, and that's when Italo House kicked off in Eurobeat and this whole other sound. And so a lot of Italo producers then went on to, you know, make a lot of, Sandro Oliva, I think, who did a lot of stuff on Memory Records, then went to Japan and made some, had a good time doing that kind of stuff. But 83, 84.
And had a good time. I bet he did.
I don't know. But 83 and 84 for collectors or connoisseurs, those are the key years, really.
One of the records that I choose, actually, is there was this sort of like duo called Clay and B.O., which actually one Italian, the other one American, Tony Carrasco, even if probably Italo-American, because by the name and surname is definitely...
I think it's, yeah.
And especially this record called Dirty Talk. It was in that time, 85, 86, apparently like the way the bass and the beats, they were made there, like the legendary... Apparently, it's the first house records ever made, they said, even the Chicago Legends house DJ, because we all pretty much know that house music starts in Chicago. But with Dirty Talk, which is supposed to be a little disco record, but like sadly they create this sort of like idea of house music.
Was there ever such a thing as an introspective Italo disco record?
Hundreds. I'd say they're
because they're not all about parties.
No, they're not all super upbeat. Okay. No, a lot of them. Italo is about several thousand records were made during this period. It's just mushroomed over there for some reason. It's almost inexplicable. Every day, with hindsight now, today we can look back and kind of map out this scene that didn't really exist at the time, and through the internet, people records and labels that were produced at the time. But no one, they were just sort of hidden in boxes under someone's bed, and suddenly they're being brought out again and collectors are going crazy and they're coming out on YouTube, and every day I hear something new.
Was there a sense that at the time that it had any value other than it being this immediate pop music? This is the latest thing. Everything had a weekly, perhaps, sell-by date on it, and then a new record came out the next week and that was what everyone was into, especially during the summer season, for example.
I think they would just churn it out. Yeah. I mean, a lot of studios were almost like factories in places like Milan or Florence, I suppose, and these guys would just knock them out.
And these are the records that you cradle lovingly to your bosom now?
Well, it depends how many were made, and if there were hundreds of thousands made.
Then they're not so good.
If it's Ken Laszlo's Hey Hey Guy, then that's not so valuable, but it's just a fantastic record.
One of the reasons we're talking about Italo disco today is because it casts a long shadow on pop music of the 80s, 90s and beyond, and obviously you guys will go on to your guys' nights and the discs you spin afterwards. But what debt you mentioned the Pet Shop Boys, Piers. Very specifically, I guess there are tracks that jump out of certain of their albums that are definitely Italo disco tracks. Mm. Has it moved in stealthier ways than simply being Italo disco tracks, the rhythm, the tempo, for example?
I suppose one of the most obvious groups or organisations who who ripped it off was Stock Aitken and Waterman in the 80s.
I was about to say.
Who did?
This was sort of the hit fact, the British sort of hit factory.
I really was about to say that because he is like, gone,
which is the kind of negative, which is the positive and negative side of what Italo offered everybody.
You're saying that with a, with something of a, with an arched eyebrow, well, or a roll of the eyes.
I like Pete Waterman. He's yeah. had a lot of good ideas.
Yeah.
It's not all of them his own, but yeah.
Is that the fact then? Is that one of the sort of key things?
Not completely. I mean, like, if you hear the beginning of PWL stuff, that the first record on Kylie, Donovan, Panorama, blah, 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 it's all about like sort of like post Italo disco influence, mm-hmm. in a kind of like commercially wise. I don't know. And then it works. So like, maybe exactly Italian disco invented the English pop, or in a way, or especially the 80s English pop.
Even New Order as well might have a death, Erasure, right. These kind of groups. Just the last 10 years, 15 years or so, a lot of house music and disco music has just absorbed Italo disco. So it's quite tuneful and melodic and quite melancholy and sounds a bit naive as well. I mean, a lot of people try to do Italo disco now, but you just can't replicate that naivety and innocence 15 years ago. So even though people say they do make Italo disco, it's music that was influenced, I suppose.
Is that because of the materials and the way that records are produced these days, or is it the intent behind them that people are kind of ripping off a genre?
Different. It was different how to do a different machine, different sort of like, mentality. And
this new gear as well, they just got a synthesizer. They weren't sure how it would work and they made mistakes. And the rhythms are always changing in Italo tracks. And I think that's why some DJs find them hard to mix, because the beats are all over the place, I suppose. Yeah. Also, it's very hard to DJ a night of Italo because it's just so intense. It's so heavily emotional.
Right.
You need a lot of breaks, I think, in between.
Before we kiss you guys goodbye, why Italo disco? Why is this the thing that floats your boat? And maybe you can tell us a couple of the records, your favourite records in your collection, where you found them.
But I think favourite is still, probably, as I said, Cano, I'm Ready, or Clan MBO, because they're and maybe they're not like the purest Italo disco records. They're more kind of like with different influence, the bass on Cano is more like kind of like post-disco, early whatever, and Clan MBO, as I said, like, is more kind of like the beginning of a genre which became house music. But obviously, like listening Baltimore and stuff like that, like it's always, and especially also like another one, Pilai on Happy Children, like it's still kind of like super fun, those keyboards, and it's all like makes you want to jump everywhere and be like quite camp actually.
For me, Italo is, I love pop music and I love electronic music and I like magic and melody in my music, and this is just a perfect combination. And I never get bored of it. I could listen to it all day.
That was Piers Martin and Severino Panzetta talking me through the finer points of Italo disco. Now we're staying Italy-themed, but changing our arena. We're quitting the dance floor for a look at Italian media through the prism of the most read newspaper in Italy. La Gazzetta dello Sport, that pink paper seen on newsstands all over the world, is just for sport and mostly just for football. Now there's a window into what Italians really care about. For Monocle, the print edition that is, I went to profile the paper and visit a match at Milan's mighty San Siro Stadium under the wing of editor-in-chief Andrea Monti. We talked football, paper, reporting, and then went to the match.
When you go to a newsstand all over Italy and you say, give me Gazzetta, they give you the pink newspaper.
That's the thing. It's nice to be the only Gazzetta, right, I suppose.
Even though there are very noticeable newspapers, local newspapers that are Gazettes.
So you're obviously waiting for anything up, like tonight. I guess the game finishes at 10 o'clock. After 10 o'clock.
The game finishes around 11.
Yeah.
So, and
then you have to come, and then you're back here, or you're watching here, and then...
I come from another world, because before being the editor of Gazzetta, I was the editor of a number of newspapers and magazines that don't have anything to do with sports. Being sports a big part of the social scene in this country, mm-hmm. so... Every newspaper or every news magazine is somehow concerned in sports.
Right.
This is very specific. But the thing that strikes me all the time after 4 years is the fact that you go into your computer, you look at the layout of the pages, and you still see 10, 15, 20 pages blank. And an hour later, everything is done.
Right.
So that is the magic. And it's still, I wouldn't call it a work of art, but it's the confirmation that this trade, the job we do, is, let me say that at least it's an artisanship, an incredible work of an incredible group of artisans, which is an Italian tradition.
What would you say the tone of voice is? Is it like a mate in a bar, or is it... Because obviously you have opinion, you have news, and then you have opinion analysis.
Very, very difficult. I think that there is a swing here due to the fact that, of course, journalism is changing. Mm. It used to be... Gazzetta never had an emphatic tone of voice. That must be recognized. Mm-hmm. Even in the years where that thing is 1982. Gazzetta was like... 1.5-2 million copies.
Wow.
You didn't have football on TV.
Yeah.
You were the master and commander of everything that revolved around football and sports in Italy. But the tone of voice was never, never, never emphatic, unlike, you know, a sports newscaster.
Yeah.
We don't have an overexcited tone of voice. I don't think that anybody is ready to pay €1.30 to know something about a game that he already or she already saw on TV and they perfectly know how the game went. They're more interested, and I think that they're willing to pay a price to know what Gazzetta thinks about that game.
Okay, so then you're the brand, it's all about the...
So, and it's about the quality of what you write, and the next step is to try to put together a very popular newspaper, popular but not pop, never pop, very popular, with the concept of a quality newspaper. Because whoever reads a newspaper and pays that kind of money in Italy wants something more. And something more is our ability to pick out exclusive stories, to give a technical account that nobody else gave, to go deeper, not to give an account of the match, but give an account of the personalities who were decisive in that match.
I think it's a painting on the photograph, maybe sometimes.
People love people. Journalism is still very much something about people rather than problems. So you have a technical side, which is a technical focus. We are very good at that.
Yeah.
We are better than TV in most of the time. We know something more because we have a big journalistic apparatus. So we come out, for example, when you have the market, it's a typical situation where we know more than TV, and we know before what is going on, if somebody's selling or buying a top player. And what we have to develop more and more and more is the ability of putting together every day a novel. Putting every day together a film, a movie, with actors, with situations, with... It's not reality or simply sports results that can put together a newspaper, a quality newspaper right now. You have to work on it and to be able to develop in that respect a great work of art every day.
That was Andrea Monti, editor-in-chief of La Gazzetta dello Sport, talking us through that great love and preoccupation of Italian print, football. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back with a look at and a listen to the weirdest and most wonderful few minutes of nightly Italian TV after this.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, every night on Italian TV and on Rai 3, one of the state-run channels, lurks a strange and subtle, weird and wonderful few minutes of TV. It's worth watching for its name alone, Blob. Blink and you'll miss Blob, though. It's just a few minutes of clips, nicks from various Italian and international news sources, and spliced together in a sort of order and set to some surprising music. A bit of opera here, maybe some Italo-disco there. Our man David Pleasant wrote a little piece on Blob in this month's magazine and then sat down for a chat with the show's producer, Cristiana Tocchetti.
Buongiorno dal TG1, ore cruciali per il destino del governo. Poco fa è terminato il faccia a faccia tra Enrico Letta e Matteo Renzi.
Blob is, well, you know the movie, The Blob? You couldn't define that, could you?
No, it's quite
okay.
Hard.
Well, exactly. So Blob is a blob. It's a melting pot of things that we have been watching on TV and movies that we might remember, songs that we might like, and it's all put together so that in the end it makes sense in, you know, the eyes of the watcher.
And it is a really specific, particular show, perhaps to Italian TV and Italian culture, this series of clips spliced together from all the broadcasts of Italy over the previous day. What do you think it kind of represents? Does it have a satirical function? What are you trying to achieve?
Well, it depends on what really happened, because as you might know, Italy is very... bizarre politically wise. For instance, for the last 20 years, we had to deal with Berlusconi, which gave us a lot to work about. Lots. And so it depends on the day. You know, it might happen that one day something tragic happens and obviously you can't laugh about it. And some other days where, you know, political matters and, you know, something happens and then you need to laugh about it. And so that's the point to make in the end. You watch all the TV of the day and inevitably that TV is going to be conditioned by the main events. And you, well, the ironic thing is that you pick up pieces also because you want to add some sort of a pepper, spice to that particular piece. For instance, if I see former Prime Minister Enrico Letta, who actually has a very nice face. He looks like a mouse, in a good way. And so obviously, if I have to do with it, I want to put some movies or scenes that remind mice, you know, Mickey Mouse or something like that. And so we go on. It's inevitably not politically correct. That's our goal, I would say.
Mi verrebbe da dire soprattutto chi vuole venire qui al posto mio deve dire che cosa vuole fare.
Quanto guadagna?
guadagna cavolo al mese lei
8.000 euro.
8.000 euro
e le dico
all'anno,
di più. Sa cosa vorrei io?
All'anno,
sì, mi faccia finire.
No, all'anno,
faccia per 12, faccia per 12.
Risponda.
Why does this exist in Italy? It strikes me as something that wouldn't exist on British TV, even on American TV, or on anywhere else, really. There's something very fluid and flexible about Italian television, wouldn't you say? Is that why you think Blob exists?
First of all, we exist because copyrights are not so legally caged in Italy. So we have the freedom to pick up TV pieces without paying for that, which obviously make us very free about many things, you know. It wouldn't be possible to edit Blob in the UK or anywhere else in the world because, you know, you should pay too much to do it. And also, I think that one good thing is that Italian TV is very, very rich. Quality-wise, I don't know. I can't say it's the highest quality of TV in the world, but at the same time you can choose. You have a very, very big range of choices, and that makes our job easier.
Un tema di cui normalmente non si parla mai. Non si parla mai perché è un tema assolutamente poco sexy.
That was David Pleasant and Cristiana Torchetti, the producer of Blob, what we think might just be the best few minutes of TV anywhere in Italy. And if you're wondering why we've come over all Italian this week, look no further than the latest issue of Monocle magazine. Our Italian media special hits newsstands this week, and there's plenty more in there besides. Still to come in part two, we're moving away from Italy to focus on this year's Berlinale Film Festival and some of the documentaries which premiered there. And I've never seen producer Katie so excited. Netflix House of Cards is back for a second series. She'll be asking Peter White what he makes of it. But fear not, Italo disco is never far away. So let's enjoy a bit more. That was Klein and MBO with Dirty Talk, and we'll return to the dance floor at the end of the show. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, and in a moment we'll be dissecting the new series of House of Cards, but first, a stop-off in Berlin. The month of February typically brings snowy flurries and a bitter chill to the German capital. It's by no means the best time of year to show off the city to a dazzling array of international movie makers. But this year, the 64th International Berlin Film Festival came with unseasonable spring temperatures that warmed the star-studded Potsdamer Platz. As always, the festival was jam-packed with around 400 films across 12 festival sections, screening mostly international and European premieres, including 10 in the Panorama Document section. Melanie Sevchenko joined in the excitement at one of the most important dates for the international film industry.
The red carpet at the Berlinale never ceases to thrill the diehard cinephiles and curious passerby who call Berlin home. Potsdamer Platz comes alive with an international crowd that is buzzing with a passion for cinema. For over 60 years, the competition section has been the heart of the Berlinale, setting trends for contemporary cinema and screening new productions from across the globe. And on opening night, droves of media and fans alike are crammed on the other side of the velvet ropes to catch a glimpse of their favorite showbiz personalities. But while film lovers will never die out, the industry is experiencing changes.
I think we're more in trouble than we were ever before. But I would more say we're in a crisis. And actually, a crisis very often is the start of something new and more fresh. It doesn't have to do with bad will. I think it has to do with the changing media landscape.
Paul Paulvilles is the director of EDN, the European Documentary Network, and has a long track record of working with international documentary co-productions from both a commissioning and production point of view. I caught up with him at the European Film Market.
I believe that for the very first time in 60, 65 years, media isn't evolving anymore, but it's a real revolution that we're going through. The traditional platforms, cinema and television, are losing their importance. They will always exist, but in 5 years' time, they will represent maybe 15% of the whole landscape. Everything that is happening on the in the broadband sector with fast cable, fiber cable and whatever, that's going to be a big difference. And of course, there's a financial crisis. Film funds money gets down. So it's a combination of technology, which is changing everything, and bad moment in time, less financing available. But is this going to kill documentary? Not at all. But we're going to see new forms of that documentary emerge. But the core of documentary, you know, taking reality and treating it in a creative way, that will never disappear.
One particular documentary that is taking a new form is the short Smile and the World Will Smile Back by both Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers. Director Yoav Gross from Jerusalem runs the video project Biti Zalam, which gives cameras to Palestinian families to document their lives and human rights violations in the West Bank. Law permits the Israeli army to enter Palestinian homes at any time, but it also permits Palestinians to film these actions.
Usually we get footage that documents human rights violations, but sometimes, you know, once in a while, we get a scene or a situation or footage that we think that has something more to it, that captures something cinematic and something humane that's bigger than just human rights, you know. We decided to try to edit it and to see if there's a film in it. And gladly, when we finished, we discovered that there is.
Smile and the World Will Smile Back is a collaboration between the film editors at Biti Zalam, including Yoav Gross and his partner, Ihab Tarabia, and the Al-Hadad Palestinian family, who shot the invasion of their home by the Israeli military. Through the 20 minutes of film, the cameras passed from family member to family member. The result is cinematic tension in a very real situation, fraught with humor, subtext, and political complexities. Back at the European Film Market, I meet up with Artur Liebhardt, who runs the distribution company Against Gravity and the documentary film festival Planet Doc Review in Warsaw. He tells me that in recent years, A-list festivals are taking a greater interest in documentaries, now more than ever.
But Berlinale is the one of them which already did it many, many years ago. So it's still an absolute leader in this interest and presentation of documentary films. I'm looking for personal story, and I'm also looking for global story. And the best if both are in the same film.
Of course, it's the feature films that have the longest tradition at the Berlinale. But oftentimes, work is screened from regions with very little film tradition. One such place is Ethiopia. Director Rosesini Berhan Mahari, who was born and raised in Ethiopia, but educated in the United States, brought the stunning feature Diffret to the panorama. The film follows 14-year-old Hirut, a village girl who was abducted and raped on her way home from school. To escape, the girl shoots her captor dead and must face a life sentence. Based on true events in the mid-1990s, the film tells the story of lawyer Mieza Ashenafi's struggle to set the young girl free.
Hirut. አንቺ ጎበዝ ልጅ ነሽ ራስሽን ካደጋ ለመከላከል ማድረግ ያለብሽ ነገር ነው ያደረግሽ
Diffret looks at the Ethiopian custom of telefa or marriage by abduction while exploring what happens when centuries old traditions are broken.
I'm very careful about using the word, you know, tradition versus modernity, you know. This particular tradition has been there for centuries and it's a harmful tradition. The little girl said no to it, and she was aided by the lawyer who took it all the way to the Supreme Court. So the idea of people fighting for something that is wrong, not necessarily suggest a new chapter or a modern society, but having a chance to examine their particular tradition and say, we don't need to keep these harmful traditions. So for me, the transition of the society happened because for the first time, they were given a chance to debate openly or not to take any of their traditions at face value.
Premiering at Sundance, where it won the Audience Award, Diffrit has not yet screened in Ethiopia, though it's garnered major media coverage. With another festival year wrapped, everyone has something to take home. A favorite film, a great story, or a new deal. We've all got plenty to talk about. Until next year. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thanks, Melanie. Berlinale is now over for another year, but you can catch up on all of it at berlinale.de. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, Machiavellian scheming, power mongering and corruption. House of Cards, Season 2. Next.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The House of Cards on Netflix, the TV and film streaming service's first foray into original drama, wowed the critics last year, becoming the first ever web-only series to win a primetime Emmy. The macabre political drama returned last week on Valentine's Day, which you could argue is the kind of sentimental event the sociopathic political animal Frances Underwood, played by Kevin Spacey, would recoil at. Interesting timing indeed. It comes at a good time for Netflix, who recently reported full-year net income of $112 million, causing a 16% rise in their share price within hours of the announcement. And they're not the only players in the field. Amazon Studios recently released the second round of their pilots, asking for viewer feedback on which shows to commission into series, including an offering from the X-Files' Chris Carter. Well, one person who was looking forward to gorging herself on the whole new series of House of Cards for Valentine's was producer Katie, and she invited Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast, who, as of last week, was one of the lucky few to have caught a glimpse of the new series, into Midori House to find out more.
I will faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter, so help me God.
The road to power is paved with hypocrisy and casualties.
I need to prove what the Vice President is capable of.
I know you'll do whatever you think is best.
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. Welcome back.
Towards the end of the first series, it all starts to go wrong, or for certain people, as Frank Underwood is rising to become eventually Vice President, spoiler alert. After the fact, he's basically killed someone, and to get that and framed it as suicide. So the second series starts with all that hanging over them, and there are a number of reporters, including the character played by Kate Mara, who has been sleeping with him and is no longer sleeping with him, but she has now figured out that he is behind this dastardly plot. And the start of the second series seems to be, if it's possible, to be even darker than the first. The relationship between husband and wife has become even weirder and even stranger, and sort of the power couple continues to emerge. And then there's this backdrop about this group of reporters who are still sort of stumbling on facts and trying to figure out exactly what has gone on. So, towards the end of series two, I wouldn't be surprised to see more made of that.
Yeah, because I mean, there was this sense in the first series that things surely had to unravel at some point, and surely he couldn't, Kevin Spacey's character Francis could not carry on this kind of web of deceit and power games without some kind of failure. Do we see any indication of that at the start of the second series, or is he coming up trumps still again?
Not quite. Is he coming up trumps? I mean, he's still in control, which I think is one of the big things about the show is that Frank Underwood, the character played by Kevin Spacey, you know, it's one of these anti-hero characters. He's a bad guy, but you're sort of rooting for him to do well. And end of series two, what will happen? Will he become even more powerful? And perhaps, and in fact, they've commissioned a third series as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if at some point he becomes president.
And you mentioned it earlier, the relationship between Claire and Francis on screen. We're just going to play a little trailer clip, which we've got of the two of them, and then we can talk a bit more about that after.
Is it hard being a politician's wife?
Of all the sacrifices that you've had to make, I'm not going anywhere.
You say that, but this could all backfire. You've made a powerful enemy.
Some people think that your marriage may be more calculated than you let on.
Shall we rehearse?
It's time we go on the offensive.
But he's a dangerous man.
We can be dangerous too.
Now tell me, am I really the sort of enemy you want to make?
I don't know whether to be proud or terrified.
It's an incredibly complicated and complex relationship. I think when you start watching the first series, you kind of think that she's not in on this until you sort of realise that she's just as dastardly as he is. And I think in series two, you sort of see even more of that. You see her, particularly with what she's going, you know, there's some storyline going on with her non-profit and what's around there. So yeah, it's this incredibly complex relationship, which is, you know, you haven't really seen. It's the sort of, the Bill and Hillary, you sort of, you wonder what they've sort of based this on. But yeah, no, it's certainly a strange coupling.
And Netflix itself is going from strength to strength. It's looking good for them at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, no, everything they make seems to be gold. The story of House of Cards is probably the perfect example. Is when they pitched this around Hollywood, everyone else, all the other networks, wanted them to make it as a pilot, and they said, you know what, we've got this cast attached, we've got this great writer, we've got David Fincher, we don't really need to do a pilot. And Netflix came in and said, you know what, we'll give you 26 episodes straight to series, you just go and make them. You know, reportedly for around $100 million to do. So they just let them get on with it. And I think that's really interesting, is that they can sort of take this creative control, whereby I think the TV channels are a little bit scared or certainly more fearful of doing that with this type of thing. So yeah, no, the Netflix is not going anywhere. In fact, it's, you know, we're going to be watching more and more, I can imagine, this year.
When the first series of House of Cards came out, this was Netflix's first venture into original programming. And they were kind of pioneering this, really. But the market's a bit different now, isn't it? I mean, yeah. How competitive do you think it is out there?
It's become incredibly competitive, as you say. Yeah, when Netflix did this, this was the first real show that you could have seen on traditional television. And, you know, there'd been web video before, and there'd been, you know, attempts at smaller scale productions. But this was the first that was a real big deal. And since then, yeah, they've certainly had some rivals. So if you're going to take on, you know, someone, you're going to need a lot of money, which Amazon, being the sort of main candidate, has managed to do. They've done it in a slightly different way. They've set up something called Amazon Studios, and they've started piloting TV shows, whether it's drama or comedy, and then they sort of let one episode go out online where people can watch. If you're a member of Amazon Prime, which is their strange next day delivery service, you can watch online, and then they sort of trying to gather the data as who watched what, and then they'll see what they can make into series. There was a show with John Goodman, another sort of political comedy that called Alpha House that they launched, and that's sort of been picked up for a full series and then moved into a second series. And they've got a few others. There's one called Bosch, which is based on the detective novels by Michael Connelly, and that's a sort of dark crime drama that looks like a Big Bet and looks like something that, you know, might not necessarily take on House of Cards, but it's certainly been the next sort of stage of this kind of online video.
So yeah, the first round of pilots they did last April, the second wave has just come out recently.
Yeah.
Are they able to gauge how successful that model has been in terms of letting the viewers kind of decide which series they should commission?
Yeah, it's the one thing that they have over traditional TV. So the other pilot that they've done this week is called The After, which is written by Chris Carter, the guy who famously created The X-Files. And you can imagine that's a really smart bet, because it's the kind of people who would watch this stuff online. And what they can do by then, they can see who's watched it, where they've seen it, what part of the country, what part of the world they've been in, and they can see exactly how they've rated it. They can see whether they've watched the whole thing or they've stopped halfway through. So yeah, in a sense that they have more control and they have more data than TV channels do. So they can kind of influence what they do going forward, which, you know, is fascinating in terms of what we only get TV that we, you know, we accept, or will we get shows that perhaps are slower burn? I can't imagine something like The Wire or Breaking Bad ever coming through this sort of model, because people wouldn't necessarily have been attached to it in the sort of first 30 minutes.
And I imagine that industry events nowadays, people are clambering over themselves to be able to talk to someone from Netflix or someone from Amazon. Yeah. Do you think we see any other players coming through that are serious competitors to that?
That's a good question. Yeah, yeah. The people who work at these companies are extremely sought after and hide very carefully, and they're not very public. None of these companies particularly like talking about what they do. The problem with it, and the problem with competing with Netflix and Amazon, you know, the biggest online retailer, is just the amount of money. There are very few companies in the media space that can pump this amount of money into programming. And so we'll see a few try. I'm sure we'll see a couple that will try and fail. And, you know, we'll never know. There might be someone who comes in and does it even more successfully than Netflix or Amazon.
That was Peter White talking to producer Katie Bilboa. And if you want to indulge in that new season of House of Cards, it's all available now on Netflix. While the pilot's for Amazon Studios is available on Amazon Prime Instant Video or Love Film. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be enjoying a session from the mighty voice of Anna Calvi and hearing how Syria's art scene has found a new home in Beirut. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher, as ever, was the whiz with the glue gun. Time for one final song this week. It's Italo Disco, of course. This is Greta Vivi with Cinema. Thanks for tuning in. After the song.